The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Every year, we invite some of the most interesting people in America to come talk with us at the New Yorker Festival. Writers, musicians, inventors, and leaders in every sort of field you can think of. And we'll start today with the writer and trans activist Janet Mock. Mock made her name with a best-selling memoir called Redefining Realness, which is about her childhood growing up trans in Hawaii and Texas. And there she writes about gender, sexuality, identity, and self-discovery. The book won many awards, and in the last few years, Mock went on to do a great deal more. She wrote another book, she signed a deal with Netflix, and she worked as a writer, director, and executive producer on the FX drama Pose, which just finished its final season. Staff writer Hilton Alls joined Janet Mock at the New Yorker Festival in October 2018.
I thought I would start by declaring that there are two Hawaiians that have changed my life, you and Bette Midler. Any state that can produce the two of you is okay by me. So I wanted to, for those folks who haven't seen or read Janet's books, rather, Redefining Realness and Surpassing Realness, it's a really quite extraordinary story. Tell us a little bit about those first years in Hawaii, and also it's a very complex marriage that your parents had. So I think in order to understand where you're going, we need a little bit about where you're coming from.
Yeah, my dad is a black man from Texas. He joined the military, he joined the Navy, and he got stationed. His first duty station was in Hawaii, where he met my mom, who was a civilian working in civilian service on Pearl Harbor Naval Base, where he was stationed. She's a Native Hawaiian woman. They got married, had me and my brother, Chad. And there was some, at least it seemed like a semblance of marital bliss in the beginning. My father loves himself and he loves women. So he went out and, you know, sought out pleasure in the way that he wanted to outside of the commitments he made to my mom, which broke her heart, which led her to a lot of heartache. And I remember one of my only memories, I remember them being in the same room was, and I write about it in my first book, is my mom, my mom's attempt and cry for help by slashing her wrists. And so that sort of dysfunction was the normalcy for me growing up.
There's a really extraordinary section in your first book where your father takes you to Texas and you're exposed to a kind of Christian fundamentalism really that had affected his life. What was that like for you, especially since you were already feeling gender difference in the world?
Well, my father definitely took on the role of, you know, I'm your father and you are my son, and therefore it's my responsibility to correct you, right? So all of your feminine ways, I need to berate them out of you, police them out of you. So he was like the number one container in that sense. His job was to contain me. And so when my mother and father split up, the first thing my mom did was send her two sons to go live with their father.
Did she feel that she was investing in their future masculinity?
I think so, but I also think that she was also, you know, looking for a new life and a new start. And so by sending her two young children to go live with, you know, their father was a way for her to have a break from having, you know, four children. So she could take care of the older two and then let us go to be with our dad, which was his responsibility to take care of us in that way.
And that was very wrenching for you because you were very close
and loved my mother. I was obsessed with my mother.
How did it work out that you went back to your mother after a time?
I I think my godfather, who was my father's Navy buddy, mm-hmm. came to visit us and saw how we were living. Mm-hmm. And he contacted my mother, and my Auntie Joyce did as well. She found her in the phone book. Mm-hmm. And I know, very old school. And they called her up, and I remember O.J. was being chased in the Bronco.
Yes.
When this was happening. Like, I remember the moment when I talked to my mom and I was on the phone with her as this, like, madness was going on television and everyone else was paying attention to this, and I was like, the greatest headline in my life was that my mom is, like, reconnected and talking to me and saying that I'm going to come send for you all.
How long had you been away?
Almost 6 years.
Yes.
And almost 6 years without contact, too.
Why was that contact denied?
I don't think it was denied. I think, well, my father moved around a bunch because once a girlfriend was tired of him, then he moved on to another girlfriend. Usually a long list of single mothers who took us in and, like, became surrogate mothers to us. And so I think that my mom lost contact. I think my mom also has to, you know, take fault and responsibility for not really prioritizing these two children that were very out of sight, out of mind to her.
Yes.
So she was like, this is your father's turn and I'm gonna go live my life. And she had another baby and she had another fiance and she was very happy in her world until they broke up, and then we were back in contact.
How old were you when you went back to Hawaii?
12.
And what was happening to your insides?
Well, I was starting to feel very, I don't like to say the word trapped, but I was feeling very, very tightly contained in my body. Mm-hmm. And I found myself taking these risks and making these social experiments in a sense of, like, starting to come up with new identities. Mm-hmm. So I had Keisha, who was very near and dear to me, and Keisha started out talking on the phone to boys, and then Keisha wanted to go out into the world and start experimenting. So I remember once I went out as Keisha. I had long curly hair at the time as a tween, and I started this flirtation with this boy who I was just, like, deeply in love with, mm-hmm. At my cousin's house. And one day he came over, and he knocked on the door and asked my aunt, and my father was there, and he asked for Keisha. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, she has long curly hair, da da da, and they're like, Keisha doesn't live here. And then my dad quickly put two and two together, and that's what led to him cutting my hair eventually. And so I think a part of me was seeking out a space in which I could be freer, and that space just happened to come in when my mom sent for us to come back to Hawaii.
Yes.
And she had a lighter touch around all of that stuff. She had a higher, quote-unquote, tolerance for my gender nonconformity. Mm-hmm. And I was able to meet new friends, and that's when, like, the queen of my life came in, which was my best friend Wendy, and
yes.
She really was the savior for me.
In your books, gender is so philosophically handled, and I was so moved by what you were saying in terms of society being a fixed thing and that you had tried to adhere to that for mm-hmm. some time before you met Wendy, mm-hmm. and she asked if you were Mahu. I'm so glad that I pronounced it properly, Mahu, and tell the folks what that means.
Well, Mahu is a Native Hawaiian identity and term, a label for people who live outside of the gender binary, largely folk who in our loosely, I guess, Western translation would be like trans women. Mm-hmm. And so anyone that was outside of the male-female kind of binary who lived outside of that. And so for me, I remember in the seventh grade, my hula teacher was a Mahu Wahine.
I love that you had hula lessons. God. I want to live there. Yeah.
I know. Yeah. And so, like, the fact that, you know, the Department of Education in Hawaii hired a trans woman, like, my yes. everyday life just was changed and shifted. You know, I didn't have to look to Law and Order or Ace Ventura, Pet Detective, or Silence of the Lambs to see trans people represented. They were a part of my everyday. I had hula lessons 3 times a week after school. And so Kumu Kauai was this person that was just, she took up space. Mm-hmm. And she, I hate to use that term, but she normalized, you know, gender nonconformity and being different in that sense. And then I met my best friend, Wendy, who clocked me at the playground and was just like, bitch, what are you trying to do here? Like, we can turn this buzz cut into a Halle Berry do if you want, you know, like, we can remix this. And so she gave me like a...
How old are you?
I was 12.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just got so lucky that within the first few months of being there, I found this best friend who had this, like, you know, this hallway of femininity in her home. I always saw her as a queen. She very much saw herself as a goddess. Mm-hmm. That's her, so I'm gonna respect her identity. Yeah. But she was just—
How old is Wendy?
She's a year older than me, but okay. We were in the same grade. Okay. Because, you know, she's a little slow. in terms of books.
Yeah, yeah. She could read, but she couldn't read.
Yeah. But she was very much, she was so big.
Yes.
Like she had when I met her, she had a green bob. You know, she wore like super high socks with like, you know, the stripes on them with like rolled up soccer shorts and like a tied top and was just like her backpack bouncing around, you know, the campus. Yes. And so because she was so big, yes, I could just hide behind her. So if I started tweezing my eyebrows, no one really noticed. Or I started, you know, wearing eyeliner, no one really noticed, you know, because Wendy was always doing more. She was always five steps ahead of me.
Yes.
And just so much more brazen. And so that was contagious, to have a friend who didn't care so much about what people thought. And I'm not the only girl that she did this to. Like, she literally was the passage. Like, the Underground Railroad was like Wendy's house. Of transitioning.
I was about to say the Trans Underground Railroad. Yeah. That is the best TV movie. You have to write it, please. Trans Underground Railroad. I've been living for this. That is the greatest thing ever.
So that's what it was. It was just a space of play. And she just made it seem so just easy. Like, you just make a choice. Like, this is just what you do. And then you do this next. And here's these other girls that you can meet. And here's other examples of people. I remember...
And also how to be safe, too.
Yeah, and how to be safe. And then she just had this network of people that she knew. And so she introduced me to drag queens, and she introduced me to trans women who performed in, you know, drag clubs. And I remember I would have these, like, kind of these breakdowns and stuff because someone said something about me at school or, you know, and Wendy was just so dismissive of it. Like, she did not tolerate that at all. Mm-hmm. And she was just like, why do you care so much about what people think? Mm-hmm. You know, and she just constantly challenged me in that way. And this is in middle school.
Right.
You know, and so like this sense of self, like she became the foundation into which I found self-confidence and self-assuredness and certainty in who I knew I was mm-hmm. versus what everyone else was telling me that I should be, whether that was at home or at school or with teachers. She was the person that was just like, you need to be sure about who you are. Like, why would you want to be wobbly about that? Why would you even let that be open to debate?
Well, because the emotional transition happens way before the physical, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. What was happening to you emotionally in terms of transitioning?
After meeting Wendy, I knew very early on about the, you know, the idea of medical transition. Like, you take Premarin and then you go on to shots and then, you know, you have whatever surgeries you want to have. Like, I knew that, like, it was 1, 2, 3, done, right? Mm-hmm. And so for me, it was always something that I was planning toward. I didn't know how I would economically be able to afford it. Mm-hmm.
Staff writer Hilton Alls talking with the writer, director, and activist, Janet Mock. And just a note that their conversation addresses the sex work that Mock was drawn to in her youth. And it may not be suitable for everyone.
One of the sort of harrowing sections of your book, the first book, certainly, is getting the money to pay for the transition. Mm. Tell us about what was necessary for you to pay for it.
Yeah, for us, you know, there was this block called Merchant Street, which was in downtown Honolulu. It's where the girls worked. They were engaged in sex work, in the sex trades. For me, it was, I remember I first went there when I was like 15, when I was able to like go out at nighttime. Mm-hmm. And we would just go and like hang out with the girls and like talk to them and see them. And they were these glamorous goddesses who, to me, were just so... At first, I came in very much with like my National Junior Honor Society hat on, which was like, I can never do what they do. That's disgusting. Or, you know, all these puritanical views that I had in my head about what it meant to use your body, your only asset in a world that's not taking care of you, to really take care of yourself. Mm-hmm. Right? And so I remember I was given an opportunity with this woman named Cheyenne, and she... had this regular who had basically, you know, outgrown her and was, you know, whatever. And he pulled up and saw me, and he was like, I want her. Mm-hmm. And I remember this sense of, looking at myself, and again, this same, like, dissonance from, like, this experience about to happen to me, then also thinking about the different kinds of ways and alternatives that I could have had. And at this point, I wanted to graduate to shots. And I knew that my mom, too, at that time was struggling with addiction and codependency in her relationship. And so home was very unstable. Mm-hmm. And so the way in which I wanted to feel stable was to take control of my body. And so I knew that by doing this $60 hand job that I would be able to have 2 months of hormones, right? And so I remember making that decision to get in that car and at 15 years old to do this and to continue to do this with this man for like the next 2 years of my life. And that was my way in to sex work.
Another parallel, part of the parallel to that story about the body is the story of the mind. Mm. And one of the things that is so impressive, of course, are the ways in which you write and become an intellectual, and not just about things that affect you, but about the world. Your consciousness starts growing once you become a college student. And can we talk a little bit about those years? Mm-hmm. Because you were secretly writing, too. Mm-hmm. And then you had a wonderful therapist who suggested, why don't you keep on with the writing thing?
Yeah, I was very resistant, yeah.
Yes, and it's a great book, and I won't give most of it away, but can we talk about your development as a mind and as a writer?
Well, I think once I got out of myself, at least in terms of how I felt in my body, I started sharing my body and then also just expanding the way in which I thought about all the things that I was going through at the time. And so I think one of my first relationships was probably the first space in which I started telling stories about experiences that were that I had just had. Mm-hmm. And so having this boyfriend and sharing, who I was kind of the first points in which I was actually exploring myself and what I thought and what I thought about what I went through and the people in my life. And so that's kind of what started me writing. In grad school, I think moving to New York City, which just was a calling ever since I watched Felicity. And there I made the decision not to be open about being trans. And it was freeing to be like another young person figuring out who I was and being in student loan debt and going to NYU.
What were you majoring in?
Journalism.
And what was it that you thought that you could do as a journalist that you couldn't do, let's say, as a fiction writer? Were you just not drawn to fiction?
A trade, number one. I felt I could make money being a journalist. Like, there's jobs for that. Whereas a fiction writer, I was like, how am I supposed to afford doing this?
Yes.
And so for me, it was practicality. I was like, I can work at a fashion magazine and eventually become a features editor or something. That was my dream and my goal at the time.
But something happened. You started to write celebrity pieces to support yourself. Mm-hmm. But that got very sort of tired very quickly,
no? It did, yes.
Why was that?
There's only so much you can write about Angelina Jolie and her children.
Yes. And you started to do something. Was it with the support of this therapist, this idea of writing about yourself?
Yeah, he just told me, he was like, you should keep going with that. Because I would sit in here and I would sit in that room with him and just talk about all of these anxieties that I had. At the point, I was like in a relationship with this guy and I was thinking about leaving that relationship. And I thought, maybe I can't leave it because who else is going to love me because I'm trans? And like, once they find out that I'm trans, they're not going to want to be with me. And I had all these pathologies in my head that I had learned from the world that I grew up in, that I was not deserving and worthy, right? Mm-hmm. Of love and affection and all this stuff. And so I was in therapy to unlearn all of that. Mm-hmm. And so he believed that there was a part of me that like wanted to express so much of this stuff but had never really expressed it. And he was like, you have quite the story. You should probably sit down and think about like really just spending time in the morning before you go to your job at People Magazine and go and, you know, sit and just write for yourself for 1 hour. That's all you have to commit to doing. It doesn't have to be good, you know, but I think that I think there would be a lot of healing that you can do for yourself. And that's kind of where my first book began, was through those journaling to myself.
Extraordinary moment happens when you're writing, you know, this hour every morning. You start to find yourself, and before you know it, there's a book. Mm-hmm. And it's I can't recommend it highly enough. But there's a significant person comes across your book, and it's a man named Ryan Murphy. You've heard of him? and he has a lot of interest in queer communities and so on. Mm-hmm. How did Ryan get your book?
Agents, I assume. he was looking for, I think he was looking to add a trans woman of color into the writer's room. Mm-hmm. I didn't think he knew
what. In what show?
For Pose. it made history for, assembling the most, trans actors as series regulars. Yes. There's five trans women of color who are the centers of the show, in addition to the magnificent Billy Porter. And so our show is really, before that, he requested a meeting with me. I flew to LA. I met with him on the set of Versace, which he was directing. And he told me right away about Pose. Mm-hmm. He told me what he wanted from me, which was to move to LA and write on the show. Mm-hmm. And you should come. It's going to be fun. And that was our meeting, really. And then 3 weeks later, I was in LA and I started working on the show and as a writer in the writer's room.
And had you ever worked in a dramatic form before when he hired you?
I was very dramatic, but no. No, I hadn't. And I always thought that maybe I would adapt one of my books for the screen in some way, and that's how I would get my in the industry. I never knew that I would be hired as a writer and then quickly promoted to producer doing the pilot. And then we said that you'll get to direct the script that you wrote as well.
Let's look at that clip, please, of Janet's directorial debut on Pose.
You gonna leave him? We have children. I'm a mother before I'm a wife.
Maybe that's the problem.
The problem is my husband is a weak man who lies. I let him lie. His lies let me keep pretending.
Pretending what?
That all I ever wanted was to be Mrs. Stan Bowes. I still love him.
Me too.
Did he ever tell you he loved you?
Yes. Do you think he could love me and love you at the same time?
What were you doing in that big hall with all those gay men and drag queens?
That's my home.
You live there?
No, honey. My community. Mi familia.
But how could a woman be a drag queen?
Transsexual.
No, I don't believe you.
I think you. It's a compliment, you know.
No, that's not possible. I mean, Stan would never do that. You're a woman.
100%.
Prove it.
What, you want to see my dick?
Yes.
I'm sorry for what I did to you. And I'm here to talk. But I got boundaries. I'm not bothered by any part of who I am except that. Everything I can't have in this world is because of that thing down there. If you want to see who I am, that's the last place you should look.
If you could, would you direct the film version of Redefining Realness, which really does need to be on screen?
I am writing the script now.
Yay! Can I ask something shady?
Okay.
Who would want to play you? Who could play you?
Well, there's a couple versions of me in it. So we have the narrator version, which would be present day me at age 26 then. Mm-hmm. The framing is that she's telling her story to a guy that she's falling in love with, or mm-hmm. I am telling my story to a guy that I'm falling in love with. I would love India Moore to play me.
Oh. Yeah. The minute I saw her, I said, that is a star.
Oh, yeah.
because you can't not look at her.
Yeah.
Brilliant casting.
Yeah. You said brilliant casting.
thank you, Janet.
Thank you, Hilton. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
staff writer Hilton Auld talking with the writer, director, and activist, Janet Mock. Their conversation was from October 2018. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
In the winter of 2007, a songwriter by the name of Justin Vernon returned to the Wisconsin woods, not far from where he grew up. Just a few months later, he emerged with the album For Emma, Forever Ago. And it was his first album produced under the name Bon Iver.
I am my mother's only one.
Since then, Vernon and various bandmates have released 3 more records and won 2 Grammys. He also became a frequent collaborator with Kanye West. The New Yorker's Amanda Petrusich spoke with Vernon at the New Yorker Festival back in 2019, along with Brad Cook and Chris Messina, who also worked on Bon Iver's album, I.
So a lot of people, I think, first came to know you, Justin, as kind of a dude with a guitar, but in recent years, you've become something of a master collaborator. It seems to me that one of the central tensions of Bon Iver is that kind of push-pull between the individual and the collective. So do you think of Bon Iver as a band? Is it a more kind of fluid enterprise?
It's never been nailed down for me. You know, if anything, it's the closest I feel to a true way to describe it is it's like a little town that's growing, you know, forever and ever. And it did kind of start out with just me. But I'm always kind of constantly thinking about how you're never really alone. When you are physically alone, you got there vis-a-vis the people that you know, made you who you are. And so in a way, I think when I thought of that name, Bon Iver, when it was just me playing the music, I did imagine a town, a community, so to speak, so that's the closest I get to naming the thing.
So as a Bon Iver nerd, my sense of how you guys work is that it's somewhat modular. You're kind of building a song from pieces in the studio, and I'm curious, and this is a question for all 3 of you, how you know when a song is done?
Yeah, I definitely think there's times where half the room thinks a song might be done and the other half doesn't, and that could be years that it goes on. But I think what we ultimately figured out is it's a feeling. And I think, like, at least for the 3 of us, it was a pretty simple litmus test about, like, were we all psyched on the song? Did we all feel like this was moving us at the core? And we left Texas feeling pretty confident. We still readdressed a few little things, but I think that's all it can be with this, is that because I think the way that Justin writes includes so much possibility from source material, for example, you know, we just got to like find whatever the common emotion is, and then we sort of go from there. And, you know, ultimately make room for the voice, however that happens.
Yeah, looking at each other in the eye and being like, is it good? And then Chris would usually be like, no.
Chris, is that true? Are you the kind of control group?
I suppose so, yeah. I mean, I'm not always right.
Chris is the most respectable officer on the force.
An incredible record.
So For Emma, through the new record, I think is one of the most masterful four album runs I can think of, and also indicative, in my opinion, of a really extraordinary range in terms of style, tone, and sound. And I wonder, and again, this is a question for all three of you, do you think about genre? I mean, either as listeners or as, you know, performers, producers, is that kind of figure into your experience of music, kind of questioning what genre is this, or even interrogating yourself in terms of what genres you are drawn to?
I've never liked genres. I mean, I got to meet Quincy. We got to meet Quincy Jones, and maybe consciously we do try to screw things up a lot to just like shake loose any sort of, you know, somebody staring at you, feel like they're gonna melt a laser hole through your brain or something because they're expecting you to do something. But I don't think we don't want that.
Yeah. So there's a song on the new record that's effectively titled Shittiest Day in American History. And there are a few other tracks that allude to the national condition, to climate change, to our president. I'm curious, as you know, songwriters and producers, sort of how much politics you're kind of comfortable allowing into the room. Because I think it's a balance a lot of artists are struggling with right now, kind of how big of a, you know, how much space you should give those ideas.
It's so tough. You know, got in a argument with, I'm name dropping Kanye now, but got in a big argument, you know, with him about it. You know, I was willing to listen to a certain point, and then I just wasn't because I ran out of patience. And I think we run out of patience sooner than we'd all like to think. And it's amazing to me that people that I, you know, agree with mostly would be, you know, more on the left. And I feel like it's, you know, people with empathy. But when you're looking at the right side, or the side that I look at and I always imagine to be, you know, evil or something, to not go there, to not approach with like pure love and empathy, you're going to be in a battle. But then again, I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to have that much patience. I don't know how to get not angry. And I'd like to be better at that personally. But I mean, as a musician, you can sing about it and you can emote about it and feel about it. I mean, being open to understanding that we aren't right, I think, is probably our best bet. And certainly writing songs is a vulnerable place to be in to start.
So, I mean, lyrically, Justin, I feel like your work tends to, you know, completely resist narrative extrapolation. You often aren't telling traditional stories, or at least you're not telling them in traditional ways. And I think your language is really beautiful, and it's really evocative, and it's complicated. And I'm curious how you write lyrics, sort of what the process is. Do you keep a notebook? Is it more spontaneous and improvised?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly a lot of that, a lot of trying to improvise something into existence that will exist forever. Sometimes you also got to just work, you know. It took some pretty firm hand holding of Brad, because there's just big giant holes, or I'd be like, no, I think that's it. I don't know why. I don't even know what those words are, if they are words, but we need to keep it. But just to have the, you know, you have to put in the work. And it isn't easy. You know, I just started writing in a notebook again instead of my computer, just to get, it's much less distraction. So you're always tweaking it, I guess.
But there was a typewriter at one point.
I was trying to be like retro, you know. I mean, it's like a romance thing. It's like, I'm a writer. I better have like a Smith and Corona.
I think the million lyrics came out on there.
Oh yeah, the million lyrics did come out on the typewriter. Hot.
Worth every penny.
$20 probably.
All million of them.
I should add one more little detail that's kind of a context clue, is that invention of words too is it's part of the fabric of at least Justin, but our friendship, and that we used to play Scrabble and just completely not use actual words. The only the only rule, and this was stone cold serious, the only rule is you just had to confidently define whatever your word was.
We got one quick word we have to share. Was Brad's word scunlit. S-C-U-N-L-I-T.
This is looks gross on paper.
It looks gross, but and we asked him through tears of laughter what the definition of scunlit was, and he just looked at me dead in the eyes. He says, it's a group of motorcycle dudes ripping a 180 at one time in a parking lot.
Just gotta go there.
Right, rip a scunlit, boys.
Scunlit.
It's very Shakespearean. So Justin, I too am a very big Northern Exposure fan. I'm holding for applause. There's no Northern Exposure fans. I had to resist making this entire Q&A about the series, but I have to ask you, while we have a minute left on the clock, what are your thoughts about the reboot?
There's a reboot?
I can't believe I'm telling you this news.
I've signed at least 5 online petitions. And I didn't know. When did this happen?
You made it happen, apparently. They have announced this year that they are, you know, circling the wagons. There's going to be a new season.
I'm not
going to
say I'm worried.
Yeah.
I am a little worried about that, but also uncontrollably excited. I mean, that's where the name of the band comes from. If you don't know, I was watching an episode. It's called First Snow, and it's like the whole episode is like not people going on a diet, like eating a lot of pie and pancakes to like, well, got a carbo load for the winter. And I just like, that's my people. and then every year for the first snow, they walk out and they greet each other and they say Bon Iver. And I just was like, that's it. That's me. That's my town. That's my upbringing. That's where I exist. It's my favorite. It's like, I wouldn't call it my favorite TV show. It's my favorite thing ever. It just speaks to me so deeply.
We have time to hear some music. So before we leave the stage, I just want to thank you guys so much for coming.
Thanks, y'all.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. The New Yorker's Amanda Petrusic speaking with Justin Vernon in 2019, along with his co-producers Brad Cook and Chris Messina. And 2 years down the line, we're still looking forward to that Northern Exposure reboot. Stick around for a live performance from the band in just a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from the New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
I'm David Remnick. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Now, this hour, we've been hearing conversations recorded at the New Yorker Festival. And before we go, we've got a live performance from 2019 by the band Bon Iver, led by singer-songwriter Justin Vernon.
I will see you up now, down the back of the Ridge. There's just something that I got to show you. There is Dormer and there's right in the common case. It ain't nothing that you're saying is true. With your long arms, try and just give some. Your standard premonition, all this phallic repetition. Boy, you tell yourself a tale or two.
Well, I know that we set off for a common place,
and the lines have run too deep.
How much caring is there of some American love when there's lovers sleeping in a street? So serene.
Thanks, y'all. We want to leave you with this thing. We've been leaving the last show we play in the encore. By the way, encores are weird, right? We should just call them what they really are, is pee breaks. We assume that we're going to get an encore because everyone always gets an encore, it seems. That's not being self-diminishing, but we, at the end of the night, we like to play this song. I hope you enjoy it. It's the last song on our record, and it's kind of what we were talking about earlier. I think it's got all the stuff in it.
Was a friend of mine. You'd have known. You'd have known. I could profit. I could rabbi. However, everywhere isn't everywhere. This is not a veil or a fairy tale in the least. So what of this release? So what of this release? Some life feels good now, don't it? I think I need to have a leaving plan.
Thank you all so very much. And thanks for supporting us. We'll see you, okay. Thank you.
That was Bon Iver, Justin Vernon, accompanied by Sean Carey, Jen Wassner, and Mike Lewis. They performed at the New Yorker Festival in 2019. Their latest record is called I, I'm David Remnick, and thanks for listening. Have a great July 4th weekend, and we'll see you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.